First of all, thanks to the organizers, and especially you, Niaj, for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here. And yeah, I'm not Alex Nielsen, I'm Julian Westerweg, and I will be talking more on the significance estimation side on the topic, and Alex will go on further about the methodology. So first of all, since the original paper from Jad and Niaj and Hanadika, right, has been published online, we have been looking at the analysis, and as you have seen, the results are very exciting. So we've been trying to characterize more on the methodology behind that and see how effective the methods that have been used are for finding these kinds of waveforms, because they are based on the LIGO Open Science Center. And yeah, first of all, we probably all know that the gravitational wave detectors and the data mostly is dominated by noise, and we're looking for weak signals therein. That is, we basically first have two questions. One of them is, how do we find something? So how do we design a search to find something? And if we think we have found something, have we found something, or are we just picking up noise? So that's the basic question. And yeah, Alex will talk more about the methods and how effective these are, and I will be concentrating now on the significance estimates, because there we have made a different implementation from the original analysis and get some results, which I'm going to show first. So first we're looking at the differences in our significance estimates. We'll just quickly, Jad already covered this nicely, recapitulate the model and the search procedure that we used there. So this is going to be technical from that side. We compare our significance estimation procedures, look at concerns for both methods, because there are, and then have a look at noise stability, short transient noise, and finally showing the results for the different events that we've seen. So first, some numbers, nice and in red. We've seen that events can be looked at singularly and in combination, and we've seen that the combination of events yields a higher significance or lower p-value. We're just talking in p-values here to avoid confusion about sigmas. So what we have seen is some 1% p-value, meaning that if we repeated the same analysis on random noise, we would expect to see only in 1% of the trials a similar signal-to-noise ratio, as I measure in this case, as for the actual event. So that's nice. We find similarly about 2% with our method, just looking at only 1509-14 with this nice peak. We found, well, you reported some 11%, 23%, so there's a similar factor between these. That's interesting for that part. But there's also other versions of these combinations we could make, and there's a different range of p-values we find, which can go up to 0.2 for certain combinations. So one should have a further look at what these yield, because finding something in 20% of random trials is pretty low, and finding 1% is much more exciting. So just very shortly, about our analysis method, we are not looking for a different physical model. We just used the very same model, thus the very same template is what we are looking for. That is, here we see the original. This is mostly the inspiral merger and then ringlon part. So inspiral is to the left. The original template, and the model comes with a set of parameters, which we already heard. The one directly determined is the delay time between echoes, just from the picture of traveling between the membranes, the travel time from one to the next. So that's called delta T echo, and because of the uncertainties in the parameters of the original event of the black hole merger, there's some range, so that's a determined but range parameter. The first delay time from the original event to the first echo, T echo minus T merger, is supposed to be the same, but maybe slightly different due to nonlinear effects, which we have already heard. So we expect that the peaks in that SNR you showed would be at T echo minus T merger equals delta T echo. So that would be the expectation. Thus, this small region we have been looking at. And further, yes, a free parameter is the amplitude of the first echo relative to the original event, and also the dampening for the subsequent echoes from one to the next. And not written in here are two more parameters. One is just measuring how much of the merger, that is, how much of the signal before the peak we're introducing here. I think that's called T0 in the original analysis. So that's also varying how much of the original signal we include. And as you can see, if you look precisely, no, I think in this resolution you actually can't. There's a phase inversion. So there's a phase change from the travel inside and outside back again. And in this model, that's just kind of hard-coded to a phase inversion. So each echo has an inverted phase with respect to the one before. So that's for now. And also very shortly, sorry for the now wall of text, that's the search procedure, which we essentially just implemented right as you did. So we take the log waveform, we find the best fit to the data, we produce a pure echo template, that is, we remove the original event from both the template and the data, we are just looking for the echoes. We produce a template bank that is not evenly spaced in the parameter grid, and Alex will talk further about how to do these. We then do matched filtering with this new waveform, maximize the SNR squared over all the parameters for each x, where x is what I described earlier down here, t echo minus t merger in terms of delta t echo. So yeah, this is where the expectation of this value 1 comes from. We expect the first echo to be at x equals 1. So that's the exciting region we are looking at. Yeah, we maximize the SNR squared and allow some parameters to vary between the events, that is the amplitude and delta t echo, between because delta t echo is determined differently for the different events. And the rest of the parameters are essentially kept the same between all the events. And now actually delta phi is the phase change and has got a name. Okay, so first of all, we made sure that we can reproduce in terms of the SNR squared. This, I think, in black is the plot you showed for the combined events, the first three LIGO events, and in red overlaid is ours. There's some differences sometimes, but in general, the SNR is recovered pretty precisely. Or just for 15.9.14, where I have no overlay ready right now. But there we again see this peak at x is about 1. So that's one of the exciting points. But just to mention at this point, we have heard that the phase flip was hard-coded in the model. But if we are maximizing off of the SNR squared, then actually we are losing the phase information. So we could have multiples of pi. And we just tried enforcing that for 15.9.14 in this case. So this might be either an inverted or the original phase. And if we just enforce that, we get this right curve. We see that's always the same or below the other, because if we do not enforce any phase information, then of course we are maximizing over more parameters, essentially. So this peak here vanishes. That just tells us that if we want to just use this analysis and use the results out of that, then perhaps another phase change is favored by the model, or by the data. So that's just what we can take from this.
Sorry, I don't understand. Can you explain this? So you actually have the minus 1 or not?
Yeah, exactly. For the original analysis, the model said that there should be a phase inversion between the, which is of course just an approximation, but for that should be a phase inversion between the original signal and the next echo and the further echoes. That corresponds to this red line if we enforce this phase inversion. If we do not enforce the phase inversion, then we're allowing for either the same or the opposite sign, and that yields that peak. So what we can track from this is just that the data favors in terms of this one peak. We can do the whole analysis, of course, with enforcing or not, the opposite sign of phase. Okay, so, but I said I would mostly talk about significance estimates. There's two methods, because up to now, our analyses, aside from different implementations, have basically been the same. In significance estimation methods, they are not. We just abbreviated your names as ADA because it's nice to read and say. And how does that work? As Jared shortly explained, we first find the maximum SNR squared in that range of x, that is this 2% region around the expected value. Then calculate the SNR squared again in a larger range. Note that here is delta t echo theory, that's just the theoretical prediction. If there's just delta t echo, that's the free parameter, so they can have different values. But this is just necessary here because of some troubles in the implementation. So that should not make much of a difference that we're using just this one value here. One can worry about that, but likely the effect is small. So just say that we're looking at a region of 9 to 38 delta T echo. In case of GW5914, that would be 9 to 38 times 0.3 seconds, about that range. Just slightly adapt the maximization, as I said. Then, as you said, divide that region into these 2% segments, which we have been looking at in that new parameter that is an approximation to X. That gets us 1,480 segments, which is nice, and we calculate the p-value very simply, just counting the number of these segments where there is at least one peak in SNR higher than for the data close to the event, divide by the total number of segments, and get a p-value. So that's a very simple method for that. As is ours, do the same first step. Divide all available data, meaning not the range 9 to 38 delta T echo, but the 4,096 seconds that are online on LOSC for each of the events, into first 32 second segments. Why did we that? Because we did see that 32 seconds was just the length of the template supplied on the LIGO Open Science Center. So that's what we used first. Then we noticed these templates actually look like the following. We first have 16 seconds of the actual signal, followed by a flat line of 16 seconds. So only in this later 16 seconds are the echoes introduced. And when we remove the original event, we turn that around, and we have first a flat line, then echoes. So we can just as well double the number of background estimates by just using 16 second segments, because that flat line would not correspond to any change in the signal-to-noise ratio. So we divide that up into 16-second segments then, which gives us about 256 intervals, well, about 250, actually. Then we perform the exact same analysis on each of these data sets without changes whatsoever, and do the same thing, count the number of of data sets with a higher SNR peak and divide by the total number. This is some cartoonish plot just showing that in principle. So there's lots of short intervals in one region close to the event, and in this method, there's a smaller number of longer segments in a longer time range. So both of these, however, come with their problems. So let's go first. We heard already that we need independent samples of the noise background to get an estimate on the significance of any findings. That's fair enough. So the samples of detector data that we have seen, these 2% stretches, they do not overlap. That's fine. So there's no dependence between these. But we need not only using data as a starting point for the template. This X was essentially the starting point for the template to be not overlapping, but no data should go twice into the same part of the analysis, because then there would be an interdependency between the two sets of data we've been using. So what does this mean here? We find that these very short time shifts, these 2% and delta T echoes, so 2% of 0.3 seconds, say, are of course much shorter than the about 16 seconds of templates we're using. And because of the long nature of the templates, because of the repetitive nature, this would mean that shifting these only by a small amount of time, the echoes may overlay on the same data, and we have to characterize how much independence there actually is and how many independent data sets we can get. Okay, there's also always the concern that right after the event, if we are just using that time, there might be contamination or further echoes depending on the parameters if the dampening is very low. So if the echoes are repeated almost unchanged, then of course these would also go on for very long. But let's focus on the first part for now. A simple method to visualize that would simply be calculating the autocorrelation of those templates, which is very straightforward, and you can perhaps guess how that looks like. If we have several repetitions of similar waveforms, that is, these echoes, then we just see that the overlap for some set of parameters that we've chosen to be not entirely unfavorable between these different echoes. If we shift one echo onto the next, then we get another peak in the autocorrelation. That's just what one would expect. And these, of course, drop pretty precisely with the dampening factor, in this case 0.5. So we can see there's about 0.5, there's about 0.25, etc. And we see that if we choose as a measure of independence, oh, really? Okay, if we choose as a measure of independence, say 1%, then we need about 2 seconds of time shift, which means that, doing a short calculation, these 9 to 38, right, delta T echo might yield something on the order of, say, 28 independent samples where there's no overlap between the different samples. So that's a number we would like to improve. Concerns about the other method basically are all based on the fact that when using all the data, we are, of course, moving further away from the original event. The data is perhaps non-stationary. It is known to be non-stationary. So we want to sample the same data. Is data further away from the event still the same data? There's no consensus of a perfect method of characterizing when data is actually the same, when there are different instantiations of the same noise. So we try to have a few simple graphs on that. One would be plotting here. These are the data sets in chronological order. So up to 250 times 16 seconds. This is just the peak SNR in each of the data sets, fair enough. And just looking by eye at this distribution, there is no clear trend. That's not a very strong argument, one could say, but it's at least one measure of graphs we can get on that. And we can also see very nicely how we are calculating these p-values. We're essentially just counting the number of these red dots above the line. The line represents the SNR peak in the event data set. That's just one option. You can do that for other combinations of events, but Alex will talk further about these. A plot we have not seen from Jihad, which I actually thought we did. This is just the SNR squared samples over time. And again, just adding in more data sets in chronological order, we can try and see whether there's some obvious trends. See, here's the first 8 data sets. We can just keep adding these in red and turning the rest black. So just going in time. These seem relatively random, of course. Also not a clear argument there, but there is no obvious trend for these. So that's just the samples and the higher occurrences.
Which one is close to the event, which one is far, I guess it's
close and far. The blue one is just the SNR samples in the data set of the event. So the occurrences of higher SNR square, that's just that plot we saw in your paper, essentially. And we repeated the same thing for all of the 250 data sets and tried to see whether there is some time trend we can obviously see. Well, okay, these are just for fun. But in the rest, we could see that at least I could not detect a clear trend in how these move around in time. So that's not an indication of unusual instability in the noise, I guess. And as a last point, just kind of a cautionary tale. When we originally did the analysis for AVT-15-10-12, which is kind of special, and Alex will also talk about that, we first found this outlier here, which is also exciting because it's somewhere close to the middle, somewhere close to the event. Interesting. Very high peak SNR compared to all the others. But there are features in the noise that are, not only is the noise non-stationary, there are also special features. So to say, and one has to look for these. There are flags in the data, so one can try to look these up. And we did and found that actually there's a short transient noise, that red line in the widened data. So that's just this peak there, and very short templates, such as single echoes, match very well to these short transient noise. And we found that for that set, there is this short peak, and all the time one of the echoes was matched to that, giving a very high SNR. So one has to take care of these. And just finally, overview of our results. I think I've not talked about widened prize. We can if we want, but the original prize are just the one Jared described. And giving for both the longer and the shorter, thus the shorter are more and perhaps more reliable segments, we can give some p-values. I already said 11% versus 2% and 1% versus 11 versus 20, 1 versus 2, those are fitting nicely. If we add in the fourth event, 17104, we find that there's a factor of 2 going up in the p-value, whereas I think you said you had a factor of 2 going down, right?
No, down.
Also up. Okay, so that's the same. Great. Ah, I was wondering about that. I thought it was that's really great. And interestingly, something seems to be special about LVT 15.10.12, and we would have to look into that further, because as soon as we just use the GW prefix events, we find a p-value of some 20%. So the others are trending, and we see we should add in more or change the analysis method, and dropping LVT somehow mystically gets a factor of 10 into the p-value, which is kind of interesting. Sorry for perhaps going over time.
That's okay. Thank you very much.
Yes, please.
So at the beginning you showed this plot with different phase shifts.
Yes, I can try to just... that was quick. That?
Yeah, so did you try to add an extra parameter, like the phase shift equal for...
No, unfortunately not. This was just this one-shot try and see... as we noticed that we are losing the phase information, what happens if we actually enforce that just to this model? So no, we have not included a phase into the model, which we should, absolutely.
And do you try other values, like, so is the blue line the maximum, or there are better combinations?
For right now, it's just these two values. It's either a change, the blue is, as it says, 2 pi, so no change in sign. The other one is forcing a change in sign. That's all there's to it.
Actually, I cannot resist. I have to ask this question. So did you try removing that glitch and then do that? Because it seemed like you said there is a glitch somewhere in the LVT.
I see. The results for LVT were with the glitch removed, yes.
Oh, okay. So if you do remove it, this doesn't change the p-value very much.
No, essentially it's this one higher point, so it's instead of 3 over 250, it's 4 over 250 or something. And we excluded that from that analysis after we found it, yes.
I see.
Yes, I don't understand the motivation for removing the glitch. Isn't that precisely what you're trying to characterize on non-stationary noise compactness?
I see. I think if we know about glitches, then we usually exclude these for that very reason. Yes, of course, if we were not picking up glitches and wanted to characterize these as part of the noise, then we should just leave them in and live with it. But I think there are several schemes of trying to remove these glitches and finding these, and this is also how we found this one. I said, oh, this data set is strange, and one of our colleagues said, let me look, yeah, there's a glitch. So.
But you're not worried about the conditional probability in that process you just described, biasing your results? It sounds a little strange to me.
It sounds strange just removing that glitch.
I mean, okay. It's sort of the definition of biasing data, right? Like, you look at something and say, I don't like this, so then come up with an explanation to remove it.
Absolutely, but I think that's done all the time, no? For the detectors, if there's some extraordinary noise feature noticed, then we would try to remove this and not use it at all for the analysis.
Does it happen in both detectors? That's the question, right?
These short transients, they happen in both detectors, but not necessarily at the same time,
but,
so they are not related.
This particular one, that's the question. Is it a glitch or is it an echo? If it's an echo...
I see. That was only in, I think, Livingston. Well, I have 50% chance, but only in one of them.
It's a blip glitch, right?
Yes, yeah. but I've been informed that that's an informal name, and thus I've tried to avoid it.
But they, by definition, have no
reason.
No, one doesn't know what's there.
So we're going to have more discussion of echoes when we come back from coffee. And so let's thank Alex again.